back, everybody, to another episode of Cinema D'Amore. I'm your host, Chuck Phillips, joined by
Justin Morgan.
And we're continuing on with our feel-good Christmas films, with the one that I feel is, you know, particularly makes me feel very good. It's not my number one. I'll get into that later, but it's very high up there. And that film is It's a Wonderful Life.
Yeah,
which I know
yeah.
you enjoy quite well as well.
Yeah, it's weird because all of my Christmas movies that I watch, we're almost discussing every single one of them, the ones that I watch yearly, but they're all out of order from when I watch them. There's like one that I watch while I'm putting up the tree. One, this is the one I normally watch on Christmas Eve, which I probably won't watch on Christmas Eve now because I've already watched it this year. But yeah, it is. It's funny that it falls into the feel-good category because I think I cry almost every time I watch the movie at the end of it. It gets me. And it is like a really happy kind of ending. But it's kind of depressing. The whole movie is absolutely depressing. So it's
That's
not feel-good.
Like,
it's kind of... What it does is it's like the moment in a horror movie where you feel relieved. Like that's how the movie makes you feel so good. It's really the ending that saves you.
Makes you feel good. Yeah, that's what we'll get into that a little later. But that's like the final 25 minutes of that film is basically just like a short horror film. Like it finally ends. But yeah, overall. Every time I watch it, I don't know, I kind of forget just how dark it gets. Like I'm like I know it's about a guy that wants to kill himself on Christmas Eve, but you just forget just like how depressing it keeps being throughout the entire runtime up until the end when he's finally you know, I guess I don't want to say changed his ways, but you know, sees the value of his life. But yeah, I think it's a really interesting film too, especially the fact that it's one of those films that wasn't even considered a Christmas movie. I know it didn't even get released at Christmas time. I think it got released in like the spring, and the setting isn't even at Christmas until very, very deep into the film, like over an hour into the film before.
Well,
it's
what makes a
even
Christmas,
on Christmas
movie? A Christmas movie. Is it something that just takes place during Christmas?
I mean, if you put it that way, then that's what most people, I think that's why most people consider Die Hard a Christmas movie, just because it takes place at Christmas. It doesn't really have any,
I mean, there's
know,
a guy that
Christmas
was ho-ho-ho
written
on his chest. Like, this movie is, like you said, the last 25 minutes of this movie is like a short horror film. The last 25 minutes of this movie is the Christmas movie. Really, the rest of it's not a Christmas at all.
Yeah, the rest of it's just a look in the life of a guy that, you know, had big dreams, and then every time he saw a chance to make them happen, they were just crushed immediately.
Yeah, I think that's kind of the beauty of this film, is that you have a person that's pretty much selfless throughout the whole movie, and all his actions keep him stuck in his town and totally demolish his dreams, but he keeps making choices that are better for other people. And what I really like about it is how that attribute comes back at the end and kind of saves him. You know, these people, like you said, you're talking about the value of your life. I think that's really what this movie could be called, The Value of Your Life. Because It's a Wonderful Life is interesting, because if you look at that title for the majority of the movie, it's really sarcastic. Like, the title reads like it's something... Like, yeah, sure, life, it's great, isn't it? This is, you can't do anything you want, and you're slave to it. But at the end, it's like, you know, appreciate the small things, and life actually is worth it.
Yeah, I think that's one of the key things to really look at in the film, is that he's never forced to do any of the things that he does. If anything, he almost always has a chance to completely change, and often he's like encouraged to you know, follow his dreams. Like his family, you know, wants him to go be a traveler and explorer, but then his father has a stroke, and you know, everyone's like, oh yeah, leave, you know, you can get out of here, we don't really need you to stay, but you know, the evil old man Potter's gonna take over everything and make the town terrible and make everyone's lives a little more miserable. So he stays, even though people tell him, like, you know, you really didn't have to. And then, you know, he's supposed to leave for his honeymoon, but you know, he decides to stay anyway because he has to help everybody. But at every opportunity, he's kind of given that chance of, you know, you could just up and leave. You don't really have to stay.
Well, look at his, not to interrupt, but look at his brother. His brother was supposed to take over the family business, and he took more kind of a selfish route. It's weird the way this movie doesn't really make anybody too selfish. Like, think of the moment earlier where they go to the school dance, and those assholes open up the floor because there's a swimming pool underneath the dance floor, and they think that that would be funny. In any other movie, it would be like a vindictive, like Carrie type situation. And in this movie, they're like, oh, it's fun, and they jump in. Like that's like kind of what the director's like saying, oh, this is fun. It's funny.
Yeah.
Is this the, have you ever watched the colorized version of this movie?
I don't think so. I think the only movie I can think I watched the colorized version of, like, and even specifically like Christmas ones, I know they play the Miracle on 34th Street one a lot. I see that on TV pop up. That's like the only one I've ever watched colorized.
I have never watched this colorized, and I have, like, my set, my Blu-ray has both of them, but I'm like, every year I'm just like, I'm just going to stick with black and white.
It's a good idea.
There's a lot of people that say it's awful, but maybe they're purists. I think that's just, I don't even know the process for the It's a Wonderful Life coloring. Is it the one where they went in and just like painted over top of it?
I'm pretty sure, yeah. I mean, well, I can't say I'm pretty sure, but I would think that's probably how they did it. It's probably the same way they did every other colorization, mostly from like what the early 80s or early 80s, late 80s, whenever they started that whole idea of every black and white movie being recolored for the new TVs.
Do you think that's when this happened? I mean, I don't even know. Like, I didn't do the research on the colored version of this that I didn't watch.
I'm pretty sure that's, yeah. That's weird that they even include it, because, like, I don't know. I've never met anyone that actually likes those.
Hey, people like the whole screen version of stuff back in the day.
Yeah, I guess there's somebody out there that likes it or something like that, or somebody out there that like absolutely refuses to watch a black and white movie and is like, nope, I'll only watch it if it's in color. And I'm like, well, the Blu-ray has it. And I'm like, okay.
I'm probably butchering the name too, but you know, is it David Koshner? You know who I'm talking about? From Anchorman?
Oh, David Koechner.
Koechner's his last name.
Yeah.
My apologies. Yeah, he plays Champ.
Yeah.
He reminds me so much of Mr. Potter. Every time I watch this, I'm like, damn. I'm like, could they be related somehow?
I know what you're saying. Yeah, the way, like, I don't know. Yeah, something about the facial expressions between. Yeah, I didn't think about that until you just brought it up.
he does. He legitimately reminds me every single time. I don't think about it again. I watched the movie last night. Had I watched the movie a couple days ago, I probably would have already forgotten it. But it's like, damn, he looks just like that guy.
Another funny, I guess, casting or like look thing that always kind of made me laugh every time I watch it is the druggist old man Gower who's like an old man when George Bailey's like 10 and is like still basically just the same old man when George Bailey's like 36.
Well, I don't think he's, well, I guess, yeah, he is that old at the time when he's at the bar with the family.
Yeah.
Because my memory isn't when he goes to the dance, he's already out of high school.
Because they make it sound like he's already, because his friends are graduating college. So by the time he goes to the dance, he'd probably be like 22. Because they said that he's already missed 4 years of college because he couldn't afford it. Everybody else, all of his other friends already graduated. So he'd be 22 by then. And then when his brother comes back, he'd be 26 because his brother went away for 4 years to college. And then after that, I think the next time jump is to when he has kids, I think.
And he's got four kids.
Yeah, his one kid's at least like
8 or something.
8, yeah, I would say like at least like 8 years old or something. Or maybe even almost like 10. Like, so it's like, yeah, he's probably like 34, 35 maybe, I think, is when he's by the end of the movie when it stops jumping in time. He's probably about like 35 is what he's supposed to be.
So the druggist went from 70 to like 105 years old.
Yeah. Also interesting choice to just have James Stewart go from playing an 18-year-old to a 34-year-old and just adding a little stubble and making his hair like a little disheveled by the end to show the time has worn on him.
At least they had a different actor play him as a kid.
Yeah, they didn't go the Dewey Cox route.
That would actually be pretty funny. He's gone too. It's weird when you watch these older movies and it's like almost everybody's gone. Like even the kids are gone.
Yeah. It's the same thing when you watch like the Air Bud movies. It's like, yeah, that dog's dead. That's an original joke. I can't remember who has that joke. I feel like that might have been a John Oliver one.
Just like, honestly, like, that's kind of what I feel every time I watch an animal movie like that, you know?
It's like, yeah, that animal's dead. Unless the movie had like a turtle in it or something like that, that animal's probably dead.
The hamster from Nutty Professor or whatever that was.
Yeah. Guinea pig.
Guinea pig, yeah. That wasn't a hamster.
Yeah, it's an interesting... It's such a... I guess I can see why this movie maybe wasn't as popular when it originally came out. Because I know it was, I know people just weren't into it. And like I think they just thought it was like too depressing or something like that. Like we said, it only really has a really like happy moment at the very end. There's like small moments.
Their expectations were the other way. They were very cynical and they thought it was going to be way too positive.
Yeah, that could be it too. Might have just been, yeah, thinking that yeah, like the reaction of like, oh, that ending's not realistic. He definitely would have gone to prison.
They're like definitely they just got out of World War II. Nobody wanted that crap.
Yeah, everyone wanted a realistic depiction of embezzlement in the banking world.
I don't know. I mean, I do like Jimmy Stewart, but he's fucking odd. Were you the one that was watching the Western with me with Jimmy Stewart?
No, I didn't watch it with you, but I know what you're. I know we talked about it because you were watching that while I was watching all the Hitchcock movies and like how he goes to a 10. I said like Rope, where he's pretty subdued the entire movie, but in the final scene of Rope where he's yelling and he's like, and I know what they're going to do to you. You're going to die. And he's just like screaming. And I'm just like, whoa, Jimmy Stewart.
It's when he starts yelling where he's like, not that great. And I always think of, is it? Oh, it's not
that,
this.
That
it's
was a John Oliver thing.
Mr. Washington. Yeah. Mr. Smith goes to Washington and he does that scene where he like falls down in the courtroom.
Yeah.
And then John Oliver's like, he was a shitty actor.
Yeah, he is like, I don't know. That's just like a weird thing. Yeah, he always has the same like he's persona really good at Hitchcock, and yeah,
Rear Window and Vertigo and The Man Who Knew Too Much. Like he's really good in all those movies. I think he's good in this too. There's just a few things that slip into this movie that I always find odd. One's like Nick the bartender. I'm like, where did they get this guy? Like, he doesn't even seem like he's from the same town.
He seems like he's from like New York. Like, he has like a hard accent.
Yeah, he's talking like a 1950s gangster. And it's only 1945 probably when they're filming this. So,
yeah, listen, pal, where do you get off talking to me?
Yeah.
We don't need no characters giving the place jazz. And I'm like, yeah, I know what you're talking about there.
I also find it really interesting, too, that he finds that the person that he told off on the phone's husband at the bar. I'm like, where is everybody in this town? Like, there's things that kind of just don't add up. Like, does that guy really care that much about his wife? She cried for an hour, and then he went to the fucking bar.
Feels like the kind of guy that would have that reaction. It's like, my wife usually only cries for an hour when I beat her.
I also love the guy whose tree got injured. Comes out like, oh God, not the tree. He's like, this tree's... I mean, it's if the they didn't do tree the tree thing, if they didn't do the tree thing, then I guess they couldn't be like, I definitely ruined this tree.
Yeah.
I don't know. This guy has to come out and scream about his tree or else no one's going to believe that there was the bark was ripped off of it.
Yeah. Yeah, I think it's an odd... Yeah, I would agree with you. I think the only weird casting choice probably is that bartender. He's the only one that seems out of place. Like, everyone else is good. I like the guy that plays Uncle Billy. I guess it's like one of those things that they play really well for his character, that they don't really have to explain that he's just like very forgetful and always has problems. Cause like, as soon as you see him, they don't even really mention it. They just have like that one shot where they show where he's got like all the strings tied around his fingers to remember things. Like, they just set that up and don't like draw that much attention to it other than just like one quick shot of his hands. But they like set it up, like really set that up early that, you know, an hour and a half later into the movie, he's gonna mess something up like way too bad. And, you know, it's gonna push Jimmy Stewart over the edge.
Yeah, but he's like likable enough that you don't hate him for it. Like, he's legitimately upset that he like loses the money during the worst time ever.
Yeah.
That's actually any banker's nightmare. Probably any business, I guess.
Yeah. Anywhere that's like, I lost the deposit.
Things like that at the bank where basically they drop off their money and they have a slip for how much is supposed to be in there, and then you count it, and hopefully that's it. And we had a business once that was like $1,000 off, so you have to get somebody else to go over and count the money with you. And it's like, yeah, they're short $1,000, so maybe they're just crazy. You call them up, you're like, it's $1,000 short. And they're like, oh, okay. And then later they come back, oh, I think there was $1,000. So then they start investigating all this shit. I'm like, you didn't put it in there. I don't know what your deal was. Can't count, I'm assuming. I don't know.
Yeah, it happens.
But yeah, it's. I kind of like the idea of the little, like the town, and then going through the a Depression era. It's interesting. During the Depression era, George Bailey's like the most optimistic person, trying to help everyone out in the town. And then when times are good, he's like at his lowest point.
Yeah.
And all it does, it's funny. It's, well, not funny, like, haha, but like ironic that the thing that like takes him down is like is karma, I guess, in a way. It's not his fault. He doesn't really blame his uncle. It's just a matter of like, what did I do to deserve this? And I feel like that moment is really well done because it's such an ordinary moment. And I feel like anybody's depressed, like that's pretty much exactly what doesn't have to take much for that to happen. It's not like some crazy circumstance. Like they could have did a 10 where like, I don't know, his kid got hit by a car or something and died. And then he's like, I can't go on. This one's like, he might do jail time. I like how the auditor is okay with the fact that, like, they lost the money, but the town provided it. They're like, the whole idea of auditing something is to make sure it's being done correctly, which it wasn't, but they're just totally okay with it.
Oh, yeah.
So is this also, and I think about it every time I watch the movie, is this the creation of Bert and Ernie?
I know that Jim Henson said it's not. I don't know if it was like he at least says like it wasn't like a conscious choice to name them, but like I feel like it feels like a very subconscious thing. Like he just heard that pairing of names because those two characters are together very frequently in the film. Every time one's there, the other's usually there. So it's usually always like Bert, Ernie. Like,
yeah, they're saying their names always together. Yeah,
they're always together. So I feel like that it is a subconscious thing. I know they've asked him about it, and he's like, no, I didn't specifically name them after the characters in the movie, but I feel like it was just in there somewhere.
The Sesame Street characters. Did you see their Twitter pages?
No.
Ernie's is like friend of Bert, and Bert is like roommate of Ernie, and everyone's like savage.
That's funny. I didn't see that. I like that.
Yeah, I was always wondered about it. And there's a movie, what the hell, Nebraska, that came out years ago.
Yeah.
And there's this old couple in there, and their name's George and Jean, and those are my grandparents' names. So I always liked that they, like, it was like the first time that they paired them up. So, but yeah, it just stands out when there's a pair, like two together.
Yeah. I feel like that's what everybody thinks.
I went to make fun of my friend a little bit. His dad is Tom, and his Tom's brother is Jerry. And I'm like, who the fuck named their kids Tom and Jerry?
Yeah, after what, like Tom and Jerry were around in like the 1940s, 50s, like who after that time period was like, yep.
I can't remember if they're twins or not, or if they were like named one and then a couple years later like we have to do Jerry now.
Yeah, that's still a weird thing. Like who, yeah. There are sometimes you run into that sometimes where you just see a name and you're just like, who did that?
We had somebody at I probably can't say it. It's a first name, so I'm probably fine. Their first name was Jedi.
Spelled the same way or
spelled exactly the same way.
Okay. I was just making sure they weren't trying to be like those people that were like spelled it like Jedai, but it's like, but it's pronounced Jedi.
It's going to be like Khaleesi. It's like, it's not a name, but I mean, I guess it is now.
Yeah.
But yeah, I kind of like the whole setup of this movie. I kind of wish there was more Clarence. It's like,
he is great.
The bookend, the end of the movie is like, you almost forget about him. You forget that they're talking, because like in the beginning, he's asking a lot of questions, and I feel like it completely falls. I feel like they just completely stop. Am I right in thinking that? Or did it blend in so well that I just kind of didn't even pay attention to it?
Yeah, I don't know. Maybe that was a. This is something I don't know for sure, but I don't know. Maybe it was just always planned for you know, Clarence to show up at the end and just be like, "Hey, I'm your guardian angel." And then maybe that didn't like read as well when they started like filming. Like maybe it was just supposed to be that you know, when he's at his lowest, his guardian angel shows up. So they were like, "Well, we have to add something into the beginning to establish like who this guy is." And they just kind of put it where they could. I don't know if that's why it kind of plays that way. Like it just didn't read as well.
Well, with the weird like Back to the Future 2 plot. Well, I guess Back to the Future 2.
I was about to say, I like that you're describing it like It's a Wonderful Life stole the plot to Back to the Future 2.
Well, I just meant where they like use that idea of like you have to have some sort of crazy reason. So they have to make sure that Clarence is like a legit angel. Because they could make it out to be like he's a guardian angel, and they can make it more mysterious, but you have a hell of a lot of explaining to do where they have a whole timeline where George Bailey's not, was never alive and in existence. You know?
Yeah.
I mean, if he came in and was just like a good person and people, you know, could be maybe a little bit more ambiguous, like, was that guy a real angel? Hmm? But he had to be. I like all the, like, he's kind of weird, like, slapsticky kind of character, too. And I like when they're with that, I guess he's the cop, and he keeps dropping, like, weird angel stuff. And the guy falls over in his chair, like he's trying to just drink his coffee or whatever, and it's like everything that Clarence is shocking.
Yeah, when he keeps talking about, yeah, well, I don't have my wings.
I didn't also, know it's yet. Very, it's very homophobic when they're in the bar, and the guys and Nick's like, "You fairies got to get out of here."
that's like as most as he gets. Like I said, when he says before, like, we don't need characters around here, and I'm like, oh, I guess that was their way of not going straight for it, just like implying it when he's like, oh, characters, I get it.
Like, that doesn't, of the things that don't age well in this movie, that's one of them. And the other one's probably that, like, weird conversation Jimmy Stewart has with Donna Reed.
Oh, I thought you were gonna say the maid.
Oh, well, maybe, but it's a little bit, I guess that's not great either. But I was thinking more along the conversation goes from, what's the perfect age for him, which is like 18.
Yeah, like, that's just right.
Like, would you rather me be 17? And he's like, no, I think 18's a great age. But it's such a weird thing because what you said, he's like 22 then.
Yeah.
So they make him creepy. They make that kind of creepy. And then when he accidentally like steps on her robe and she's hiding in the bush, he's like, blackmailing her, kind of. I mean, it's more, he's gonna do any of the things that he says he'll do, but it's a weird moment of power in that movie where he's controlling the scene in like a kind of an abusive kind of way.
You're making me think of you watched the most recent Saturday Night Live, right?
Yes.
The teen movie critic that watched old movies like Forrest Gump. You can't do that anymore.
Yeah, that's exactly what it is. That is, for the record, the Christmas Jason Bateman 2020 episode.
Yeah, just for some context there, but
with the musical guest Morgan something from country music, which was weird. Like, the skit was weird.
I know what you're talking about. But yeah, that is like this. Anytime you watch any of these old movies, that's just all you feel is like you don't have to bring it up all the time. But I do always have that thought of like, you can't do that anymore.
Well, it's an interesting way to look at it because it's like you get these movies that are like well respected, nostalgia or classic, like depending. Could be something that you watch as a kid, or it could be something that just like you've watched your entire adulthood, and kids watch these things now and they hate them. You know, the kid's like, oh, I don't fucking like Taxi Driver.
Yeah.
What's wrong with you? I love Joker. It's original. It's not. Really not.
I do have to say one other thing that really struck me this time, I think, that I didn't really pay attention to before, is there's one moment, the moment that I guess feel that I relate to George the most is at the end when he finally comes home after he loses his uncle loses the money, and when he's just like walking around and he goes to walk up the stairs and the thing comes off in his hand, that it keeps doing that throughout the film.
Banister breaks in his hand.
Yeah, I was like, I've 100% had those moments where it's like something else is like really bothering you, and you're like walking through, and like your sleeve like catches on a handle or something like that, and you're like, don't
fucking start with me right now. Like, you're just like angry for no reason. Just
it doesn't happen.
Any object.
It doesn't happen too often anymore. But when I had wired headset, it would always get wrapped around like the handle of a cabinet or something.
Yeah.
And it get ripped out of my ears, and it never hurt, but it was like the most
annoying.
Yeah, like that, or like you hang up a towel and you walk away and you hear it fall on the floor and you're like, God damn it. It's not really a big thing that to get mad about, but it's just like a thing that pisses you off.
Yeah.
To walk back and pick the damn thing up.
Yeah. Yeah, it's not physically hurting you. It's just mentally like or emotionally hurts you.
It glosses over the kids. Like, they're not an important part of his life. Like, or I mean, obviously, we'd have like a 3-hour movie or something. But the day where it's like all these things that the kids are saying, I think in most movies they would play it off like, oh, it's really cute. And Jimmy Stewart's like, you are the most annoying children ever.
Yeah, when he comes home and he's like, yeah, how he phrases it to his wife. Why do we gotta have this family? All these kids.
I have like a terrible flashback too of that little girl that's like playing the piano, and then he just gets sick and tired of her playing the piano. I remember they had like some sort of talent thing where I took my taekwondo and I'd play saxophone, so I was gonna play a song for like the talent show thing. And I remember my mom was just like the entire time was telling me how terrible it was sounded. So then I ended up doing like Jingle Bells, and it was terrible because I'm like, anybody could have done Jingle Bells. But when he's like, if she doesn't know the song by now, is she ever gonna know it? And I'm like, oh, that hurts more than it should.
Yeah, that's like the final moment when he comes home, and yeah, his kids are like driving him nuts and stuff like that. Like, feels like he's slowly turning into Jack Torrance. Like the kids just like asking him questions. He's like, the one kid, Dad, how do you spell hallelujah? Do I look like a dictionary to you?
Or the kid that's like calling him, and he's like, what? What do you want?
Excuse me. Excuse you for what? I burped. Oh.
When Stephen King wrote The Shining, was he thinking of Jimmy Stewart from It's a Wonderful Life? He's like, I just wanted to end a little bit more terribly.
I mean, I honestly wouldn't, that honestly wouldn't surprise me if he was like somewhat like thought of like the way that he is at the end of this film for
that. Think about this movie. What if it didn't go that way? What if there wasn't a Clarence? Yeah. You know? This movie ends pretty dark because there's obviously heaven and hell, and George Bailey kills himself, so he goes to hell. The sequel.
Yeah.
George Bailey in hell.
It's a Wonderful Life 2.
In hell. Yeah, and it's weird too because like some of the stuff where they like every time you hear a bell, an angel gets its wings, like is literally set up maybe 10 minutes ten minutes before Clarence gets his damn wings.
Oh yeah.
Some of the things are weird in that too, where like the literary reference, like when he's reading Tom Sawyer, not Huck Finn, right?
Yeah.
And he's like all about Mark Twain. It's really weird. He's obsessed with Mark Twain. And then I think it's his uncle that makes a Peter Pan reference. And I'm thinking, oh shit, when did that come out? The animated one.
I don't know. I don't know if that would have come. Yeah.
But if the book's been is popular. Yeah. They were making plays and stuff of it. But they kind of make him out to be a buffoon. So is he reading? I don't know.
Is he reading?
He's just forgettable, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah, that's always. Yeah, it's an interesting. It's interesting how they set it up. Again, like how we said, it's not a Christmas movie it's more than an hour into the film, like more than halfway through that it finally like it's on Christmas Eve. But even then, like it's no one even says at the end that it's a Christmas miracle. They just say it's a miracle. So, but it does get dark in that last the last 25 minutes. Is,
I mean, I would consider it a Christmas movie still.
Yeah.
Or else I would have argued with you heavily when you said feel good Christmas. And I'm like, it's mostly not feel good.
I feel like I feel like you can watch it for Christmas and have it as a Christmas movie, but I almost do feel like the same way as like Die Hard. Like I feel like this is a movie that you could put on at any time and you won't feel like there's some that like if you were to watch like any of the Scrooge movies or something that are like so
the Scrooge, you make it sound like a series. The Scrooge series.
So, yeah, you know. Every Scrooge movie. Where those are just like those are obviously Christmas movies. They reference Christmas. It's like, oh, it's the ghost of Christmas past. It's the ghost of Christmas present. Like they'll say the word Christmas like 200 times in the film, whereas this only mentions that it's like Christmas Day once or twice. So I feel like this is a movie you could put on at any time and not feel like, ugh, watching Christmas movies in, you know, April.
Well, I was going to say the reason that I think it can count as a Christmas movie, obviously it can count because it takes place during Christmas, is that where it ends, it kind of is that the idea of Christmas where like people are looking out for you. It's not about what you get. It's a kind of like people coming together to take care of each other. And so the Christmas spirit per se is like the climax of this movie.
Yeah, I would say it's also the structure that they have at the end. Kind of that last 25 minutes, it almost kind of plays out like a combination of the ghost of Christmas past, present, future, because it kind of shows like all in kind of one thing. It shows like, well, you know, here's your past. You weren't there to save your brother if you don't exist. And, you know, here's what the present looks like. You know, everything's and also like in the past, you weren't there to stop the old man from accidentally poisoning that kid. You know, and here's what the present looks like. Everything's like strip clubs and casinos. And, mm-hmm. you know, here's the future. You're the woman that was your wife. She's going to just like grow old and die alone. Like, so kind of like it kind of rolls everything all together from something like any one of the Scrooge films, a Christmas Carol adaptations of, you know, kind of shows how he affected everything in the past, the present, and how the future is going to go if he were to never exist and not help all these people. Are you one of the people that thinks that life was better after Jimmy Stewart wasn't there? That Potterville was a much better place?
Yeah, it seemed a hell of a lot nicer. Wouldn't that be an interesting take if things were a hell of a lot better without him and it like disproved Clarence's point?
Yeah. Like, yeah, he goes back and like, it's like, oh, this guy's having a better life. Like, everyone looks like they're having a much better time.
Yeah, man, I think he should have done it or something awful. I mean, that's why Clarence never gets his wings, because he's the worst angel.
Yeah, somebody, I mean, if you're in the strip club business, then, you know, Potterville is your place.
It's a weird place to have one. Like, it doesn't seem like it, like, I don't know where this is supposed to take place, but it's like somewhere rural America where there's a Bedford Mountain nearby or something, they say at one point. So I feel like it's like, I don't know. It's gonna be like Colorado area or somewhere closer to us, you know what I mean? Or Pittsburgh, like the Appalachian Mountains or something. So it's clearly not a big town. I bet it has strip clubs.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't think they ever. I guess it's just supposed to be like a generic like small town USA. Like they never. I don't think
we do have a Bedford close to us.
Yeah, Bedford Falls. I doubt it was
inspired by that one.
Yeah, I don't know. Or it could be like more like New England, like upstate New York or something like that, or like Vermont, New Hampshire, like, you know, like small town. I don't know. Yeah, I don't think they ever.
I feel like I should take that snippet of us trying to figure out where it takes place in the United States and play that as a tease. Like, it could take place in Vermont or upstate New York.
Yeah.
Maybe as far as Connecticut. I don't know.
I feel like, feels like the joke on The Simpsons where they're always trying to figure out where Springfield is.
They always do strip club when things go terribly. Like, that's the...
like, that's the worst really thing.
Bad. Yeah. Well, there's a strip club there. I mean, usually, maybe questionable people. There's like, scummy ones, and then there's ones that are, like, supposed to, you know, they're nicer and well-kept.
Yeah, you know.
But I guess morally, an angel would be like, see how terrible it is? Sinners.
You just made me think the other day the local strip club the
your
Philly
local strip club?
Yeah
okay
the, yeah Philly, you know which one the Philly Crown
I do know the Philly yeah.
They had like a sign up that was that talked about social distancing at the club like they had like a big sign up outside that was like it was like we are social distancing but it was just
probably
like
a lie.
Yeah probably not it's like. It's like when you go in for the private dance, we throw down a sheet of saran wrap on your lap.
Remember that time our friend went to the strip club and they fell in love with the stripper?
It
and
happens.
They were like, no, you don't understand. She gave me an extra dance that she doesn't give to anybody else, and she's working her way through college.
Hey, man.
I wonder if he still believes that was a legitimate experience.
It happens. It's like that great Kanye song. I just fell in love with a porn star.
Or think about like hustlers. Like that's their whole thing is like they've kind of been scamming people the whole time. You know?
Yeah.
But I don't really care how people get their money. But yeah, the social distancing is funny too because the other day Steph's coming home from work and I was like, if I ordered Permanis, would you want to grab it or I could have it delivered? Permanis in Pittsburgh is the sandwich that does the vinaigrette mayonnaise. Well, not mayonnaise, but the coleslaw, the vinaigrette coleslaw with fries.
You had the weirdest way of describing that. I think if you would have just said they're the place that does the fries on the sandwich, everyone knows what you're talking about. Something about going straight to being like, they have like the vinaigrette on the greens. That's a thing that they do. Like, I'm like, no, French fries. I'm like, French fries. That's what everyone knows.
Gabagool, as Tony Soprano would say. anyways, it's like, do you want it ASAP 30 minutes ready for pickup? Or the earliest you could schedule it is like 7:30, which was like over an hour away. So it's like ASAP. And it was like, your food will be ready around 7:45. I'm like, what the fuck? It's there. All the blinds are closed. There's a sign on the door that's like, you know, do not enter. But no one was answering for the pickup. She's like, the parking lot's full. So she had to go in to be like, I need to pick up the food. She's like, completely packed. Everyone's watching the Steelers lose. That was their losing game. So it's like, you know, no one has their masks on. Everyone's probably yelling and screaming watching the sports.
Yeah.
It was like, my God, it's like a fucking nightmare. Like, I get that these people don't want to go under, but at the same time, it's just like this total disregard. Don't give a shit if they kill. Like, you went out with your buddies, watched the Steelers lose their winning streak, and then probably killed grandma. It's a weird timeline. It's the bad George Bailey-less timeline.
Yeah. That's the one we're in right now.
I'm actually surprised they never did any more of them, like more Clarence-type movies or something.
Yeah, that is a weird thing I could see them doing. Like, yeah, just having Clarence the Angel, and he has different people that he has to save in some way.
Well, not to wrap it back to Saturday Night Live, but Pete Davidson did the news, and he was talking about how people were mad because they're just doing like a reading of it online where he plays George Bailey.
Yeah,
and he's like, guys, we're just like reading the script once. I could understand if like they were remaking it and they somehow cast me.
I love his description for like why he's the perfect George Bailey. He's like George Bailey was a suicidal person that had a pretty terrible life. I'm pretty well known for being having a lot of mental health issues and being a suicidal person with a terrible life.
Yeah, I mean, it doesn't. I do like how the movie doesn't. Bless you.
Thanks.
I like how the movie doesn't really. It kind of plays the suicide in a realistic way, and they don't treat it like it's the worst thing in the world for him. Like Clarence is understanding. Like Clarence is almost like, I understand why you think you want to do it, but give me a moment to try to like convince you otherwise.
Yeah.
And then some things I feel like maybe worked better on paper than in the script. Well, actually in the final production is where like he talks about how he saved George Bailey and he's like, saved? I saved you. He's like, I'm pretty sure that I saved you. I'd be really proud of writing that. And then watching it, I'd be like, it didn't work that well, but whatever. A decent moment nonetheless.
Yeah.
But yeah, I do. Like when we get to the end of this movie, I don't know about the overall structure of this movie's interesting. It almost has like three different phases. Like the beginning is like this weird, way over-explained narrative, and then it falls off, so most of the movie is pretty decent. And then the end, it has, like, one of the most bittersweet endings I can think of in a movie, maybe besides Big Fish always gets me, or The Green Mile, that's a weird one that always gets me. But this has a weird, like, you just, like, feel so good that everybody's come together to get this, to put their money together to help him, which is maybe the only thing that's a fan, like that's almost probably more fantasy than an angel coming and showing you your life without you.
Yeah. Everyone's got all their money. So, like, doesn't even matter that they all give him, all the townspeople give him the money. Then he gets the call from his rich friend from New York that's like, I'll advance you $25,000. It's like, oh, okay, well, I guess everything's just fixed now.
Right, or the cops that were, like, clearly there to arrest him, but then donated.
They just felt that giving spirit.
It'd be funny if, like, they all pitched in, and they're like, oh, the bank didn't lose its money, and they're like, well, you still lose your job, and... You didn't follow procedure, so.
So yeah, we're still gonna have to arrest you.
Does his uncle ever do another deposit again at the bank?
Never again. He's never allowed to go there.
It's a weird moment too when Jimmy Stewart has to turn to Mr. Potter for help. Like, are they just really digging in that he's not a good guy? There's nothing that leads me to believe that he could convince Mr. Potter to help him out.
No, yeah.
You know, the moment where he has the money already, but he still goes to be like, we're in trouble. Jimmy Stewart would not be a good poker player. He reveals literally his entire hand. He's like, here's what's going on.
Here's how my life's going terribly.
You know what? Mr. Potter is another one that really doesn't age too much. I mean, he looks the same, too. He's just in a wheelchair and gets pushed around. He might have been in a wheelchair in the beginning. He's sitting, right?
Yeah, he's always in the wheelchair. That guy just pushes his silent manservant, just always pushes.
The threshold is, like, you can play, like, you either have a kid play you up until, like, the age of, like, 14, and then the same actor can play like 15 to like 100.
Yeah, once you hit that line, it's just like, yeah, you can play him. Are we gonna put any makeup on him? No.
I don't know. Sometimes that stuff kind of, it works for me. I mean, I guess, I think the reason that it maybe works in this movie better is, I mean, you do have, like, what stands out to you? You said the druggist. He's like, that seems weird. But all the time jumps, they do a really good job of doing the, they do the time jumps almost like your favorite David Fincher movie, Zodiac, where, like, the life moments aren't as big and they gloss over it, and that's the only way you can tell how much time has passed.
Yeah.
It's like, he's got kids and it, and like how his wife changes and stuff.
Yeah, just suddenly he comes home and there's like three kids running around.
Yeah, it does like the same thing, and it works that he's the same act. Like they didn't age, they don't age Jake Gyllenhaal. You know, like they don't age anybody.
No,
They don't really change hairstyles or do anything crazy. Everyone looks the same from beginning to end. But I think for the most time, people don't care too much. It just kind of keeps things constant. It's not like they have to do something where, like, now any script that I read where there's a passing of time, it's like clean shaven Chuck does this, and then it's like in the future Chuck with stubble on his face. They love to tell time with facial hair,
and then the one that they love to use in a lot of movies and TV is the classic flashback, and just have them, just give them long hair like a Dexter. Mm-hmm. Just give him that bowl cut. That'll make him look like he's only supposed to be like 17 or something like that, but it's still just Michael C. Hall.
My favorite is when they have a different actor play the child version, so they do the hair exactly the same way. Like as if their hairstyles never changed their entire life.
Yeah, that's the only way you can tell. It connects back to our...
Like they cut to young George Bailey, and when it cuts to him as an adult, they pause to basically be like, that's George Bailey as an adult, and they explain it.
Yeah.
And it's really terrible. It's an awful moment because I think within 2 seconds he's like hitting that thing saying hot dog and they're calling him George Bailey. I think people would know that that's George Bailey without you having to pause it and be like, do you know?
You just want to make sure you're very well aware.
Right. They're like, we're going to switch out the actors. I hope everyone's able to follow this movie. Everyone's like, okay, I like Jimmy Stewart's character, but I don't understand that child in the beginning of the movie.
Yeah, yeah. Was that supposed to be a different kid? Is that his kid in the future? I don't get it.
There's so many things in this movie that I think like affected other movies. Like I think of The Good Son, where Macaulay Culkin like throws his kid sister in the thin part of the ice if he tries to kill her. That reminds me of the beginning of this where like the brother falls into the ice. Also, it really sucks like for medicine back in the day that George Bailey was in the ice for no time at all and he lost hearing in his ear.
Yeah. Yeah. Also that, yeah, his brother was in for like the exact same amount of time, but apparently got out just fine.
Well, you know, it's actually kind of interesting. I didn't think about it, but I watched It's a Wonderful Life, and then I watched on Amazon Sound of Metal.
Yeah.
And they're both about losing your hearing. I don't know. I wouldn't say It's a Wonderful Life is about losing your hearing. What's it? Describe the movie. It's about this protagonist. He loses his hearing.
Yeah. That's definitely the overarching message.
Yeah, it comes into play a few times, so it's not, like, unnecessary, but it's definitely the plot of the entire movie. I like how when the druggist slaps him, he like it's bleeding from the ear. I'm like, Jesus Christ.
Yeah. He's like, you're hitting my bad ear. I'm like, what does it matter then? It's already gone.
It's also kind of really good foreshadowing for what's to come later in the movie with the druggist. Where he's like super depressed and he's in his depression, he's like putting other people's lives at risk. You know? And it kind of has that chain effect or butterfly effect or whatever you want to call it, where it's sort of like the little things that you do affect other people in great ways.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it doesn't really do that in a cheesy way, which I think is why I can come back to this movie so much. It doesn't, it never feels melodramatic to me. At moments, maybe cheesy. That one, when they're at the dance and that guy's cornering Donna Reed's character, and he's like, "But wait, let me finish telling you my story."
Yeah.
I'm like, it reminds me of that meme with the guy at like the baseball game with his arm around the girl, where everyone's like makes him say like the most like
stupid things. Yeah.
Things. Yeah.
Yeah. I haven't told my story yet.
You're annoying. No, you're annoying. Nobody likes you. Maybe he's the bully.
Maybe
he's the kid from Karate Kid. He's the protagonist, but he's also the villain. I think. So is this movie a yearly movie for you too? You watch it every year?
Yeah.
I don't know why I got into the habit of watching it on Christmas Eve, but it just seems like the Christmas Eve movie. We talked about it before. I really liked A Christmas Story. And I don't think it's a bad movie, but like it's totally been killed for me. I don't think I've watched it in 15 years, and I think if I watched it again, I'd be like, "Ah, it's too much. I watched it too many times." And this doesn't really get overplayed too much.
No. That's Christmas Story is the only one that gets really just like hammered to death, and then it's like even some of the other ones, not even just there, but like every time you go to the store, that's like all you see when you go to like look at anything for Christmas. You'll see Christmas Story. Christmas Vacation gets it a lot, although the movie itself doesn't get like overplayed on TV, but like the merchandising, like everywhere you go, there's either like the Moose mug or just something with Chevy Chase's face on it.
I have an ornament from the movie.
Which one do you have?
It's him with the squirrel on his back.
Okay.
And when you push the button, it plays like the 3-minute scene of them talking about a squirrel.
Mm-hmm. I was thinking when you said an ornament, the first thing that I thought that would be a great ornament of him is when he comes out of his house with the with the hockey mask on and the chainsaw. That was my first thought when you were like, it's an ornament of Chevy Chase from that film. And I was like, yeah, when he comes out with the chainsaw, that'd be a great ornament.
They might have already done it.
They might. I feel like maybe that's where I'm thinking of it. Like maybe they have done it and I've seen it before.
I do a lot of over the last couple of years, I've gotten a lot of like Hallmark ornaments. And the ones I'm usually more picky about are the ones that are people that don't look like people. Like Chevy Chase is like, I guess I can see Chevy Chase there. So like I'm more comfortable with like a Pixar character because it looks exactly like that character. I've done Star Wars characters or like, I don't know, my tree looks like it's a child decorated. It's just full of like, it's like a third Star Wars, a third like Disney, Pixar, and then like a third of just like somewhere in between things that should actually be on a Christmas tree. There's a lot of Nintendo, and then there's like random stuff like my Predator. I love my Predator. It's like it doesn't contrast the tree at all, except he is in a tree. So it is kind of like the first Predator movie.
Yeah.
But I see things like, oh, I got to have that. Got, Ripley in the thing that she's in, the construction thing for the end of Aliens. I'm like, I have to have that in my Christmas tree.
You definitely have to.
But now I probably need to start getting a bigger Christmas tree.
Just to add more crap to it.
Or a second Christmas tree. I like all the ornaments. This year kind of sucked. I got a bunch of new ornaments this year, and then nobody, because of COVID, is over.
Yeah, no one gets to look at all the cool stuff you got.
I know. I got Chadwick Boseman at the top. I got a new star. I got the Super Mario star. It's fun.
It sounds like it.
But yeah, I mean, what would you say to anybody, I guess to wrap it up somewhat, what would you say to somebody who hasn't seen this movie? Sell it to them. Put you on the spot.
If I were selling this movie, hey, do you want to watch a guy slowly get his life crushed under the wheels of capitalism and then have a magical twist ending where capitalism actually works for him? Then this is your film.
You sound more like you're pitching a movie than you're trying to get it.
Hey, that's definitely fun, huh? I mean, that's definitely another thing, I guess, about this movie that you can kind of say is, I guess the way to put it would be, it's very timely right now in the sense that, you know, everyone's having a hard time making ends meet, and you know, maybe if we had more people like Jimmy Stewart handing out loans to help people out get through, and less potters that are just like, well, what's it my problem if he's out on the street? Maybe you should have saved his money up. Like, it's literally, that's an exact quote from the film is, well, if he wants to buy a house, maybe he should have started saving his money a long time ago. And I think it's how,
yeah, they got that voice right. They got that voice down.
That's how a lot of it's viewed as today. When you get a lot of the boomers when they talk about like why like young people rent and they don't own anything, and it's like, well, maybe they should have started saving when they were in high school and they'd own a house by now. Like, it's just that simple. Like, if they'd have just started like saving $10 a week in high school, they'd have enough money to buy a house.
Totally. If you think about real life, my parents' age, they got out. There was a big economical boom. Not a great one, because there was kind of collapse afterwards. But my parents got out of high school, never went to college, bought a house, bought a boat, went on vacations. They got to do all kind of stuff, like things were in their favor. And now people go to college, they get a master's, they get all this debt, they get a job that they should have been able to get with their associate's degree. Another thing that you say too is everybody keeps talking about another thing is like, go to college. We go to college, and now they're like, you should have done heating and air conditioning. That's where the money's at.
Yeah.
Yeah, thanks. But yeah, not to derail the conversation anymore, I think It's a Wonderful Life is a fantastic movie. I don't know anybody who really, like, maybe there's some, like, cynicism to it because they think that it's going to be melodramatic and overly happy, and it's not, and that's why the ending of the movie works so well that we kind of ruined for you, but I don't think so. If you watch this movie knowing all the plot points, I think you're still going to be sucked into it.
Yeah, I would say that.
And we got two more Christmas movies for you after this. Actually, I guess Klaus is the only one that I obviously haven't. It's not a tradition because I've watched it twice. It's too new of a movie. But It's a Wonderful Life, I always watch Christmas Eve. And next week, we're going to do A Nightmare Before Christmas. And then on Christmas Day, we're going to have something special for you. And then on New Year's Day, I think a day or Eve. I can't remember how I scheduled it. That's kind of obscure, but I don't know.
Yeah, we've never talked about obscure films that no one's ever seen on this podcast.
It's really obscure. I think it's from like 1929 or something.
I think it's even older than that.
1921.
Yeah, because I know it's, I'm like, it's definitely, that's, I'm interested in some of these because I've never seen that one.
And our, well, maybe if we have some sort of, I mean, our the holidays lined up with our Friday release schedule. I mean, I guess in the future we could probably do the Hudsucker Proxy or something. That's a New Year's Eve movie.
Yeah, it is.
Because it's the same thing. It's the same structure as It's a Wonderful Life.
It is.
It has very little to do with New Year's Eve. It's just kind of like, that's where the climax
on it, yeah.
And it happens, and there's angels too. I guess it's a lot like It's a Wonderful Life. I never really thought about that before.
Yeah, I thought that even, I think, while we were watching it, when I first saw it, was like, you know, the Coens are definitely inspired by guys like Frank Capra and those like old-time Hollywood films. And that movie does feel very much like they're riffing on It's a Wonderful Life.
Well, we will be back next week. Our streak's doing pretty well. I think we're doing pretty well remotely. I can't wait till we're back together, but I think it's going to be several months. No James because of his work schedule. So, yeah, it's a little difficult, but I think we'll get through this like everybody else.
Yeah.
You can find me on Twitter. I'm at JJMorgan19. You can find Chuck too, but he doesn't really tweet.
Yeah, ChuckFinn66.
We're at Cinema De More on Twitter, /Cinema De More on Facebook. That's where we do our wonderful ads, so you know what we're doing next. Because we don't always say what we're going to do. We usually will like tease it the night before if we can find a good tease. And sometimes we're just like, fuck it, here's every movie that we're doing for the next month. It is not a secret. We want you to be well prepared. I'd actually be surprised this month if a lot of people couldn't jump right in because they haven't already seen the movie. We're not doing anything too wild. But Apple Podcasts, Google, wherever you listen to podcasts, if you subscribe to us, we'd appreciate that. Rate and review us. Let us know how awful we are. We kind of have a good idea how awful we are and what we excel at, and we're trying to get better.
Yeah.
I'll have somebody be like, I listened to your podcast, and I'm like, sorry. I don't know if apologizing is the best first reaction to somebody that says that they listen to the podcast. But, yeah. Feel good Christmas. Continue next week. Thanks for listening, guys.
Thanks.